That ambition may be aimed at the American presidency. Tonight on Point, the legacy and future of Rudy Giuliani. But first, we begin tonight in London. The first funeral for a victim of last week's bombings was held today for 20-year-old Shahara Islam of East London, a Muslim bank cashier who died in the bus bombing in Tavistock Square. And a chemistry expert sought by London police, 30-year-old Magdi Mahmoud Al-Nashar, was arrested in Cairo. Rob Watson is defense and security correspondent for the BBC. I asked what is known about the man arrested today in Egypt.
Well, he's an Egyptian. He's a biochemistry graduate. He's 33 years old. And most interestingly, until recently, he was living and studying in Leeds. That was where at least three of the suspected bombers last week were living. Now, the police in this country or intelligence services aren't saying for sure that he's a suspect or that they believe that he made the bombs, given his biochemistry and chemistry skills. But, I mean, clearly, that has to be a suspicion.
Robert, I wish you could just bring us completely up to date then on, at week's end here, what is known in this investigation and where it appears to be heading.
Sure, because there have been some pretty dizzying developments, you know, but in terms of black and white, what is really known and not known, not that much is really known for sure. We know that there were four suicide attackers. We know a little bit about their backgrounds. We now know something about the explosives used, and this is very important. Until recently, the British authorities had thought that there was a commercial or military explosive, but they now think that they were homemade using a kind of an explosive that had been seen in previous attacks by Al-Qaeda, and that of course is where this theory is linked to this Egyptian, because this is the kind of explosive that could have been made in someone's bedroom with chemicals that you could buy easily in a pharmacy, and so that the suspicion has to be that maybe he was in some way connected.
And is the understanding that he traveled to Egypt after the blast, or is anything known about that? Was he already there? Is that clear?
He is said to have left Leeds, he's said to have left Britain a couple of days before the attacks. Now, he has been arrested by the Egyptian police, and he has told them that he had absolutely nothing to do with the bombings, and that he was always planning to go back to Leeds, and that he was in Egypt for a holiday. But, you know, to go back more broadly to the question you just asked, where have we got with this investigation, it's important to know that the British authorities think that the four guys that died were foot soldiers, that they weren't the real brains behind this.
The police commissioner, Ian Blair, is saying that again today.
He has said that. He said that a couple of times. They just think that there had to be a kind of a spiritual mentor, someone providing the financial backing, someone to teach them how to make the bombs. They think these guys were just the cannon fodder and that the people firing the cannon have yet to be found.
Rob, in our earlier conversations, you've kind of resisted the term mastermind, but is that what you're describing here tonight, that they're looking for, or simply inspirations?
I'm not sure whether to use the word mastermind or not. All I can tell you is that from speaking to British intelligence sources, they say they're just not sure whether there's a mastermind or not. I mean, there's no doubt that they don't think that these four people acted alone. So whether you use the word mastermind or not, I guess, is a bit of a moot point. But they do believe that there are other people involved and that this is almost certainly has an international dimension, which, again, is only to be expected. I mean, if you look at previous plots that involve mass killings, invariably has involved huge international networks. And if this is Al-Qaeda, this is Al-Qaeda style. I mean, it's almost like a kind of a corporate operation. You know, people come in, like management consultants to advise on one stage of the operation, other people go out. And I think that's what the British authorities think this was, a kind of complex Al-Qaeda style operation.
And here we're seeing today Britain's Muslim community speaking up again, the head of the Muslim Council of Britain saying he wants to take concrete steps to make sure atrocities like these don't happen. This is Sir Iqbal, what is it, Sakrani?
Sir Iqbal Sakrani, exactly.
Yeah, saying, quoted here by the BBC, saying, "We are all responsible for it in a way," he said, "because very little had been done," his words, "to tackle elements in the Muslim community carrying messages of hate." Do you have any sense of how that's being received in the Muslim community? That's a very broad term, the Muslim community, but how is all this being digested?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tom. You could add to that as well that about 22 of Britain's leading Muslim scholars have also issued a strong statement condemning the bomb attacks and saying that this is not the way of Islam. And interestingly, of course, Sir Ian Blair, who we've talked about before, the head of the London Metropolitan Police, he has said that until now, at least, Britain's Muslim community was in a state of near denial. Now, you asked, well, how does all this go down in the Muslim community? And it is an extremely difficult question to answer, no doubt about that. I mean, we have a pretty diverse community here, and the idea that anyone could claim leadership in the way that, I don't know, the way the head of the Southern Baptist Church could claim leadership of the Southern Baptist. And I also suspect, rather gloomily, in some ways, I guess there are some people that are just already lost. You know, there are some people who are just not open to argument, young people in the Muslim community who have been seduced by the ideology of Osama bin Laden and an extremist Islam. And I don't think it's going to be possible to get those people back. What the fight is really about now is to say, we don't want any more people going over the edge and falling for this ideology and launching attacks.
Couldn't help but be struck by the irony of the first funeral of one of the bombing's victims today, Shahara Islam, a 20-year-old Muslim from East London, buried today. Her family saying, today our dear daughter, cause of our joy and light of our eyes, our Shahara is returning to her Lord, an innocent and blood-stained martyr. But then going on to say she was an East Ender, a Londoner, and British, but above all a true Muslim, and proud to be so. Even in the family statement, it kind of, well, there's nothing wrong with being above all a Muslim, but yet there's something, I don't know, there's something I can't quite put my finger on there.
Well, you're not the only one who would have noticed the irony about this very attractive young Muslim woman being killed by another young British Muslim, pretty much her own age. It's just a terrible tragedy. But I think maybe you may have hit on something there, which, with all the political correctness and liberality in Britain, that it's that, you know, people don't like to speak about it. But I guess, you know, one of the problems that people just haven't spoken about in Britain is, you know, what non-Muslims feel about the Muslims' worldview, if I could put it that way. And what I mean by that is that most people agree here with what Tony Blair said, and indeed what George Bush said after the 9/11 attacks, and that is, we don't think that all Muslims are like this and that they want to carry out mass suicide attacks. And nobody would disagree with that. But I suspect, underneath the surface in Britain, if you were to scratch it, you know, people think, you know, of course we don't think that they're all mass murderers or there's something evil about Islam, but we have a sneaking suspicion that a lot of British Muslims, or a lot of Muslims in general, that their worldview is not ours, that they don't think about women's rights the same way that we do, they don't have the same approach to liberal democracy. And I suspect that that is nagging away at people, and it's something, of course, that's pretty much taboo to talk about.
A lot of soul-searching coming up, clearly, within and without the Islamic community. Rob, it's been some week. Rob Watson, defense and security correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with us from London.
New York, New York, New York. This is getting to be like a Yankee game. I don't know. Well, watch out.
At the Republican National Convention last summer, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani reminded GOP delegates and the country why he became known as America's mayor. In 1994, on his second try, Giuliani roared into office with a hard-nosed agenda to turn around a troubled city. On his watch, crime fell, taxes and the welfare rolls were cut, New York blossomed. Supporters say he did what his liberal predecessors could not, pulling the Big Apple back from the brink. Then came 9/11, and the image of Giuliani standing tall in the rubble sealed his reputation as a commanding, reassuring leader. Where he takes that reputation next is a hot question. Tonight on Point, the legacy and political future of Rudy Giuliani. You can join the conversation. Are you a Giuliani fan, a skeptic? Can you imagine Giuliani's take-no-prisoners style in the White House? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Fred Siegel, professor of history at the Cooper Union for Science and Art, and author of The Future Once Happened Here, New York, D.C., L.A., and the Fate of America's Big Cities. He was an advisor to Rudy Giuliani's successful 1993 mayoral campaign and wrote some of the candidate's key speeches. He is the author of a new biography, The Prince of the City, Giuliani, New York, and the Genius of American Life. Fred Siegel, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, perhaps in a New York state of mind. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Siegel.
Hello.
Fred Siegel, the genius of American life. Where are you going with that here in regard to Rudy Giuliani?
That's a phrase Giuliani used in several of his campaign speeches in 93. It refers to the fact that before Giuliani, poverty was an industry in New York. We assumed the poor would always be poor and we would take care of them, and we would sell that poverty to Washington in return for federal matching money. Giuliani's idea was that the city should once again be a place for people with aspirations, a place of upward mobility, the genius of American life being upward mobility for the poor.
And he went after that as a prince, you say, but hardly as Prince Charming. He was a prince in the Machiavellian style. What kind of prince do you see Rudy Giuliani having been?
Well, Machiavelli's insight was that private virtues can be public vices. So the private virtue of compassion in New York meant when he arrived in office, one out of every seven New Yorkers was on welfare, 1.1 million people. The city, as a practical matter, in 1994 was bankrupt. The State Financial Control Board wanted to take it over. Giuliani moves on welfare reform partly out of principle, partly because he has no choice. Either he reduces the welfare rolls dramatically, or the city will go bankrupt.
But he moves rough, he moves hard, and it seems to have worked. Fred Siegel, we'll be right back after a short break. Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking about the legacy and future of Rudy Giuliani. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Is there a president in the waiting there? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions. Thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy. CMNDesign.com.
423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Of course, 9/11 may have been the day that more Americans than at any other moment were introduced to Giuliani or saw his stuff. Let's listen to a bit of tape from that day. Here is Mayor, still Mayor, Rudy Giuliani at the first press conference after the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001, 1:30 p.m., just hours after the attacks.
We're going to need strength to overcome it, and I want the people of New York to be an example to the rest of the country and the rest of the world that terrorism can't stop us. American democracy is much stronger than a vicious, cowardly terrorist, and we're going to overcome this.
We're joined tonight by Fred Siegel, author of the new biography, The Prince of the City, Giuliani, New York, and the Genius of American Life. Fred Siegel, where did Rudy Giuliani come from?
He grew up in Brooklyn as a Yankee fan, and that always marked him. He was always combative. He grew up Italian-American immigrant parents. His grandparents had migrated here, and he had a sense of the immigrant experience as he became mayor.
Now, it's a complicated story. The 90s were boom time for all of America, and yet there is a very distinct before and after phase change to the complexion of New York. You began to speak of this, Fred, but I wish you'd take us again into New York pre-Giuliani, New York by the end of the 1990s.
Well, one symbol of New York pre-Giuliani is a moment in 1993 when the Parks Commissioner, under the Dinkins administration, the previous administration, is giving a talk in Central Park. The lake is behind her. And as she's speaking, as she's talking about improvements in Central Park, a dead body bobs to the surface. This was the era when people would have no radio cars in their signs in their car saying, steal the other guys. Essentially, theft of radios was legal. And it was an era when asking for a cup of coffee could get you a fat lip. The key thing about New York is it has a different business cycle than the rest of the country. The country went into the recession in early 91, came out in late 92. New York went in earlier than that and didn't come out until late 96. Giuliani's greatest accomplishments before 9/11, reducing crime, reducing welfare, all occurred before the New York economy recovered.
And on the other side of New York's recovery, I mean, we've all been there. We've seen the city. You can feel the change, but describe it for us.
What happened was a combination of what's called broken windows policing and Comstat. Broken windows policing said, take seriously small crimes. The guy who smashes a bottle on the sidewalk, public drinking, jumping the turnstiles. It turned out that one out of every seven people who jumped the turnstiles in the subway was wanted on an outstanding felony warrant. The reasoning was that the guy who commits the big crimes and the small crimes, they're likely to be the same guy. That plus Comstat, which is the computer mapping of crime. It used to be police looked at statistics 3 months later, 6 months later. New York began to use, under Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, began to use statistics prospectively. Where do we deploy our people? And so when crime would be displaced by a police raid, they would be ready for the next spot to push it and push it and push it. Mm. And one of the extraordinary things about crime in New York in the 90s is it declined dramatically without the prison population increasing.
Which is an accomplishment in any time. All this done with a style that even you're an admirer, and we said at the top, it bears saying again, you were an advisor to Giuliani in his in his 1993 campaign, wrote a prominent speech for him about quality of life issues, which were, of course, core to his kind of governing philosophy. But even from your rather supportive vantage point, you make no bones about just how tough, how raw, how ruthless he could be. Paint that picture for us.
Well, I want to modify that a little time. He was tough and ruthless, but he was tactically so. The part of Giuliani that's missed, given his operatic personality, is how intelligent he is. I mean, the only person in public life I've met in the last 20 years who has the same level of intelligence as Bill Clinton. Both men are policy wonks. Giuliani studied the city charter the way Napoleon studied the topography of a battlefield before he went to war. In other words, It's too easy to talk about this public image, but much of this was merely tactical. Giuliani understood where the levers were. Let me give you a practical example. Mm. For 30 years, every mayor would try to unify New York's three police departments. We had subway police, housing police, and the NYPD. No one could figure out how to do it. The police unions always beat it back. Giuliani realized that the city funded the transit police through the Metropolitan Transit Authority, the Regional Transit Authority. He put the squeeze on them, they caved in, and all the rest followed. Giuliani understood the levers of government, how government actually worked, as opposed to the rhetoric of government.
And yet you know that he was often perceived, and of course part of this political, but not all, as vindictive, even vicious, sometimes kind of mad dog. Are you saying all that was just an act to freak out opponents and cow them?
At times, yes. Not always. But much of it, yes. Much of it was a way of saying, I can't be rolled. Traditionally, mayors in New York could be rolled. And that is any interest group. And this includes the police, by the way, who rioted a number of times in New York from the 60s to the 90s. Mm. Interest groups, if they felt they weren't getting what they wanted, would essentially threaten to to stop the wheels of government. They throw themselves in front of the train. Mm-hmm. This could be a question of riots. It could be a question of work slowdowns. What Giuliani was saying was, none of this is going to deter me. There's a moment I remember. It's about 3 months into office. Every single vested interest in the city is demonstrating at City Hall. It's a regular carnival. Mm. And Giuliani's response to this was, don't bother me. It's not going to work. I'm not going to be rolled. This is a different ballgame.
Jack Beatty, it's fascinating. I've heard Rudy Giuliani speaking just recently. He can come across as Rick Hertzberg at The New Yorker described him in the aftermath of 9/11. He described him as calm, frank, patient, tender, egoless, competent on 9/11. And you can hear Rudy Giuliani talking just that way. Yet it's that operatic personality that sort of that he made his bones with, that we know him by, and that he rode quite ruthlessly through New York policy. How do you see his New York years, Jack? And what about the national picture, national aspirations for Rudy Giuliani? Do you see him translating?
Well, that's the question. I really have no idea about that. I mean, the standard wisdom is no, because he's too liberal on social issues. On the other hand, he's something of an icon, or at least he's been thought to be. And terrorism is certainly going to be one of the main issues in the next election. So if people are looking for a strong man who at the rhetorical level and who at the executive level knows how to get things done and rally people and so on, I can imagine him styling himself a candidate. The part there, I think, that comes back to get him is what quotes someone saying he has the, quote, personality of a lunatic bulldog.
Ouch.
I'm I'm not really sure whether that part of him would sell very well, and whether people in the end would feel that that's the kind of person they wanted to be president. That maybe there is in this man, yes, some of this is tactical, but maybe there is in him a kind of permanent chip on the shoulder, or some smoldering essence that is ready to flare up and really sometimes go beyond the what's acceptable in public life. I mean, Brett has a number of incidents in here where he just seemed to lose it, really.
Fred, what makes Rudy Giuliani lose it?
Well, I think the moments when he lost it most severely were in the second term, when he was in the middle of a divorce, middle of health problems, and there were recurring police problems. Now, the recurring police problems part was his own fault. The biggest mistake of his administration was firing a man named William Bratton, who was a great police commissioner. He's now a police commissioner in L.A. and working his magic there. The
former Boston police commissioner, of course, too.
Earlier Boston police commissioner. Mm-hmm. An extraordinary man. The problem is that Giuliani and Bratton are the same person. They're intellectuals in action, who are also men of action. You know, when Giuliani came in, he had everyone read David Osborne's Reinventing Government. Bratton had everyone read Champy's Reengineering the Corporation. They're both ramrods. When they're in the room together, there was no air for anyone else to breathe.
And when Bratton got the Time magazine cover?
That did it. That Giuliani was not big enough at that moment to allow Bratton that kind of credit, which, by the way, he was justly received. But let me go back to what Jack said. There's a technical point that needs to be made here about his presidential prospects. 2008 is going to be different than all prior elections in the following way. It used to be you went from New Hampshire to South Carolina.
Right.
This time you'll go from moderate New Hampshire, not to conservative South Carolina, but to moderate New Jersey. New Jersey will come right on the heels of New Hampshire. That's an enormous boost for Giuliani and for McCain.
A big change here. Let's begin to bring our callers in. Brad's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Brad, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I live in Milwaukee, but I actually lived for 14 years in New York during Giuliani.
So what do you make of the man?
Well, you know, I admire him in a lot of the ways that your guest does. And however, I can't forget all of the travesties that he caused.
Such as?
Well, for instance, the cuts in AIDS funding were terrible for that community. Even though he's a social liberal, at least thought that way, his pandering to the right when it came to, for instance, the art show at the Brooklyn Museum, I'm forgetting now the one who did the Jesus painting, and then when he cut the methadone clinics, which was also bad for treatment in the city, and also a lot of the crime fighting is really attributable to Bratton, and certainly ComStat for sure was Bratton, but he pushed a lot of the crime out of Manhattan into the far reaches of Queens and Brooklyn, which didn't do anything for people who actually lived in New York, but did a lot for the impression of New York that tourists and others had.
So, Brad, how do you picture, I mean, it's a long shot, who knows, there's much distance to go here, but imagine Rudy Giuliani in the Oval Office. How does it look to you?
Well, you know, I get the feeling that, based on what your guest is saying, and what my impression of Giuliani is that the man doesn't have, he lacks a certain kind of, for lack of a better term, I guess, stability. To me, it seemed to me that there were times, like, for instance, when he was running, who can forget that he whipped the police who were without a contract at the time and were rallying at City Hall.
Yep.
He whipped them into a frenzy. You know, he at some point starts to serve his ego more than he serves people, and being president of the United States obviously requires a lot of ego, but it also requires a great deal of compromise. And I'm not sure that being mayor of New York, where being bullish is a virtue, is going to work on a national stage.
Brad, you really light him up for us, and we appreciate your call. Thanks a lot for calling. Fred Siegel, you write yourself. You say that Giuliani was a self-promoting, self-absorbed man who made his own enormous ego serve the city's well-being. A couple of things there. By the end of his second term, before 9/11, he was not very popular in the city that he served so well.
Not exactly, Tommy. That's a kind of rhetoric. No, when there was in the summer of 2001, there's a mayoral campaign to succeed him, and three of the four Democrats are campaigning to continue his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not quite right. But I want to take up something the caller said, because it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Crime dropped most rapidly, most sharply, in outer borough and minority neighborhoods. That's what makes Giuliani different from all the other mayors in the 90s. If I compare him to another very good mayor, Rich Daley, in Chicago on State Street or Michigan Avenue, crime is very low. It's in the neighborhoods that's explosive. Chicago, with one-third of New York's population, has had more murders than New York. Mm. Giuliani's greatest success, and I talk about this in the book, is reviving the outer borough minority neighborhoods. That's where he did his best work.
In fact, you call it one of his three great accomplishments, reviving the idea of upward mobility for the poor in a city whose economy, quoting you here, had been organized around servicing poverty. I want to invite another voice into our conversation right now, if I may. Joining us from New York, Wayne Barrett is with us. He's senior editor at The Village Voice. He's covered the city and state government in politics at The Village Voice for 20, 30 years. He's author of Rudy, an investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani. Came out in the year 2000. Wayne Barrett, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Wayne.
So, Wayne, you see how the national eye is turning to Rudy Giuliani again as the next election season inevitably rolls toward us. Fred Siegel has looked into his years in New York and beyond. Of course, Fred, an advisor to Giuliani at one point in his campaign there. But he comes away with, overall, quite a favorable impression of Giuliani's impact on the city and the way he marshaled his character, his ego, his intellect in the public service. How do you see it, Wayne?
Well, Fred just mentioned, for example, and I think it's a ridiculous statement, that three out of the four Democrats running in the primary in 2001 wanted to repeat Giuliani's legacy. I think your point was much closer to being accurate, which was that prior to September 11th, Rudy Giuliani, every poll in New York showed it was at a very low ebb. And certainly if he's suggesting that Mark Green and Freddie Ferrer, who were the two Democrats who actually made it to the runoff,
right,
wanted to repeat Rudy Giuliani's legacy, I mean, that's about as false a statement as you could make. Both of them were the polar opposites of Rudy Giuliani on a whole cross-section of issues.
But, Wayne, pick apart the reality of New York there. Before the terrorist attacks, New York had come a long way, as Fred Siegel says, from the early 90s when everybody was just writing the city off. What did people give credit to Rudy Giuliani for that? And if so, why weren't they lining up to support him in the polls?
Obviously, Fred starts with crime. You start with crime. The truth of the matter is everybody ignores it. But for the last 36 months of David Dinkins' administration, crime went down in all seven FBI categories in this city. He mentioned auto theft, or he mentioned theft of car radios. In fact, auto theft went down 28% in the months preceding Rudy Giuliani taking office. Bloomberg, for example, inherits a crime rate that's way down because of both the combination of the final 3 years of Dinkins and the 8 years of Giuliani. He's managed to lower it without any of the racial poison that accompanied the Giuliani administration. Where the murder rate continues to decline, and in Fred's book, he refers to the Bloomberg administration as a muddle. And yet the crime rate has continued, the murder rate has continued to go down here without all of the problems that Rudy brought to the city, which was a racial divisiveness that we have not seen before him or since him.
And so what are you saying? Are you saying the whole kind of Giuliani legacy is a fraud? New York sure looked pretty good at the end of the 90s.
Well, I'm certainly not saying the whole Giuliani legacy is a fraud. Does he deserve some credit for the decline of crime in New York? Yes. So does David Dinkins. Murder declined by 300 murders in the final 3 years. The murder soared in the first year of Dinkins. It dropped dramatically over the course of the last 3 years and continued to drop even more dramatically under Giuliani. The rate of the decline of crime increased substantially in the Giuliani years. The decline of crime has continued now for a full administration of Mike Bloomberg after his departure. Can we still credit that to Rudy?
Wayne Barrett, you know Rudy Giuliani has a big ambition on top of that ego, like many politicians. He must be looking at the Oval Office. How do you see him in a national context? Will he fly? And would he work if he won it?
Well, I think that if there is another terrorist event, we just had the events in London, to the degree that terrorism is at the forefront of the American mind in 2008, I think Rudy Giuliani is a very formidable candidate, especially if there's another incident in the United States between now and 2008. He has this Churchillian aura about him that's a byproduct of 9/11. So I think he would, if there's not a terrorism event and terrorism is not at the forefront of the American political mind, then he's probably not going to be a substantial candidate in 2008.
Wayne Barrett, author of Rudy, an investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Fred Siegel, we just got half a minute before the break, but in a word, there's a kind of strong pushback from someone who's clearly not a Giuliani fan.
Sure. But Wayne is wrong on each of his points. For instance, under the Dinkins years, the last 3 years, crime dropped all of 7%. Fear was undiminished. And where crime dropped, it dropped in midtown Manhattan, where private security and broken windows like policing had already been put into effect on a local level.
Fred Siegel, author of The Prince of the City. Please stand by. Jack Beatty as well. We're talking tonight about the legacy and future of Rudy Giuliani. What do you think? Does Giuliani deserve credit for bullying New York into shape? And would he, could he, do the same thing for America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
Dave is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. What do you think, my friend?
Yeah, hello. Thanks taking my call.
Sure.
I'm formerly from New York, and I admire Mr. Giuliani. I supported his initial try at the Senate race. I was disappointed he pulled out. But anyhow, he deserves a lot of credit for galvanizing the police forces in New York. And that's of some concern, though, on the federal level. You know, we have these new laws, the Patriot Act.
Yep.
And some people would think that if they're prosecuted to the full extent and a so-called law and order president were to take full advantage of them, you'd think some civil rights would be severely compromised. That's one issue. The other issue is, as a mayor of New York, he sort of looked the other way on illegal immigration. He was, on one hand, it's positive that he supported immigrants, certainly ones that are legal, deserve all our support, but to look the other way on illegal immigration is a problem. If that's openly done on a national level, the current amount of immigration would probably increase even greater. So.
Dave, let me ask you, you're a New Yorker now in North Carolina. You say you admired Rudy Giuliani in New York, but you've got this concern at the national level. Why the difference in your mind? I mean,
well, the laws, the new Patriot Act laws are extraordinary in their breadth and scope, and they would allow, I'm not a lawyer, I don't understand them completely, but it seems that they would allow warrantless tapping of telephones and searches.
So you can picture Rudy Giuliani driving a truck through that kind of
I would think that the average citizen might consider that even if he's law-abiding to his knowledge, that everything is being watched, and it does become a Big Brother type state with that type of executive in charge.
Dave, let us pick it up, and thanks very much for your call. Fred Siegel, how about it? You saw and know how it worked at the city level, at the national level, post-9/11, with the Patriot Act. Would Rudy Giuliani be tempted to, you know, push everything to the max on the kind of investigative, intrusive front?
Well, let me begin with the caller's point about illegal immigration. I think this is going to be an enormous weakness in Giuliani's presidential run. Illegal immigration is a red-hot issue in much of the country, and Giuliani's stance on immigration in New York is going to be contested. I lived some of the 9/11 hijackers lived just a few blocks from where I lived in Brooklyn. On the question of Homeland Security, Giuliani's strength is coordination, forcing agencies to cooperate. He could bring that to the national government. But I think the caller's question about potential abuses will dog him. I think that will be an issue raised against him in the course of the campaign.
I mean, but does he have a personality that could intellectually exercise restraint on that front? Or does he just go, you know, pick up the tools and take them as far as that you can?
Well, I'd point out to people that police violence in New York dropped even more rapidly than crime. Police in New York was 3% of the population. In 94 and 95, it accounted for 25% of the drop in crime nationally. Police violence dropped by about, I think, a third in those same years. So, no, it's not. People underestimate his intelligence. He's the guy who's a student of government. I think the issue will be raised. I'm not sure it's the right point. I think the illegal immigration question will come back to hurt him severely in the primaries.
Jack, Wayne Barrett raised it earlier. Fred Siegel raises it himself, talking about Rudy Giuliani being a leader sort of built for crisis, for situations where discipline and resolution are more important perhaps than personality or warmth. Wayne says if we get more terror attacks, this is just the kind of personality people may be drawn to.
Oh, yes, he would fit the zeitgeist for sure. And then all these questions about, is he the man on horseback? Isn't it something? We had a psychologist on, you wouldn't have heard this, Fred, the other night, who you were telling me, Tom, in his book, he'd done a book about disasters and how people deal with them. He was sort of picturing Giuliani as a kind of menace, that if there should be another attack, that here's the man on horseback, here's the guy who'd get the trains running on time, here's the, you know, intolerant executive, et cetera, et cetera. And I was taken aback at that. My sense of Giuliani was that he'd undergone a kind of evolution in those last years, maybe partially because of his touch with cancer, partly because of his marriage. Anyway, there was a new Giuliani. Hmm. Anything to that, Fred?
Not much, Jack. I mean, I think this was mostly his personal, you know, his personal feelings. Politically, no, he didn't change much. I think, yeah, he'd gone through some traumas. He was kinder and gentler as a result of this. But I would point out something. Giuliani's use of tough tactics was tactical. It wasn't just, you know, wildly flailing around. He knew what he was doing, by and large. Now, there are moments when he lost it, when he was going through those personal traumas. And I think those issues will be raised in the course of a campaign. People remember that moment when he took on the Saudi prince. People in the United States would like, I think.
Remind us of that moment, Fred?
After 9/11, a Saudi prince offered to donate money. And at the same time he offered to donate the money, he denounced America, denounced Israel. Mm-hmm. And Giuliani essentially told him to take it and shove it.
Mm-hmm. And there you have Mayor Giuliani. Jeff is calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm actually a fairly big fan of Rudy Giuliani, but I don't think he has a chance of getting the Republican nomination. Simply because his social views are so liberal for the party, and given that primary voters are generally more conservative than mainstream voters, they would literally have to sell out virtually their entire social agenda in order to support him, and I just don't see that as being very likely.
And you don't think there's any way that his tough guy image would trump those social liberal checkboxes?
Well, I can see the tough guy image carrying over with some people, but once you start getting especially the issues of abortion and gun control, one of my friends who lived in New York for many years said Rudy Giuliani is really only a Republican in New York, and in large parts of the United States, he'd actually be a conservative Democrat.
Yeah, let us pick it up. Jeff, thanks for your call. Fred Siegel, how about it? Abortion rights, gun control, gay rights. Is it ultimately a moot point? Is there no party that will have Rudy Giuliani?
Well, I think the call has raised an interesting point. There's a division in the Republican Party, you might say, between the party of Zeus, the party of combat, manly combat, McCain-Giuliani, and the party of domestic virtues, of social issues. And I think events will decide which way they go in the primaries. If, as I expect, the Republicans lose seats in this off-year election, a guy like Giuliani and McCain will have a better shot. But one thing to remember about Giuliani and social issues, he came late to his position on social issues. They were entirely tactical. He adopted those issues in 1989 when he first ran for mayor. He was told he had to take these positions or he had no chance. When he began to run for the Senate, not that he ever wanted to be one of 100 in the Senate, when he began to run for the Senate, he began to modify his views on abortion. I suspect he'll discover between now and 2008 he doesn't like partial birth abortion. One final point. Giuliani is best understood as a 1950s liberal. Those kind of liberals left behind by the utopian impulses of 60s Democrats, Aquarian Democrats. What I mean by that is he has an ironic, paradoxical view of the world. That's why Machiavelli fits him. And he has this sense, as 50s liberals like Reinhold Niebuhr did, of the dark side of history. If the dark side of human nature, terrorism being part of it, if that comes to the fore, then someone from the party of Zeus within the Republican camp will have a good shot.
The party of Zeus. Jack, Fred Siegel calls him an immoderate centrist.
And yet, you know, there is a checklist for many Republican primary voters, and I wonder if our caller doesn't have it right, that it would take a heck of an upset security situation for Rudy Giuliani to make it past that, and he'd have to do an awful lot of tailoring of the positions he's taken for a while now to fit the profile.
Yeah, there'd have to be a big walk back, and he'd have to go through some fire there. But, you know, suppose it's a fractionated field, and you've got two or three candidates for the right, and then it's between McCain and Giuliani in the center. You could imagine him hanging around at least a while in primaries, but you're right. I mean, the primary voter in the GOP is not the Giuliani voter.
Fred Siegel, we've just got you for another minute. Take us into the way Rudy Giuliani is seeing the world at this moment. Here we are in the middle of 2005, 2008. It's coming over the horizon. To the extent that you're in touch with him and his thinking, what is it about the White House?
Well, I think, you know, what he's involved now in financial dealings. He's got this very successful consulting firm. And right. What he seems to be doing is building a national network of business ties. For instance, he was talking about forming an alternative to the National Hockey League. Well, that meant contacting business people in cities all across the country. He seems to be building an organization.
Speaking of blood sport and full body contact politics, okay,
good parallel.
Right.
But one point on this, you know, I can imagine, and this is wildly speculative. Mm. I can imagine a McCain Giuliani ticket at some. The only person I could see Giuliani running as vice president with, a kind of Cheney like managerial vice president, is with McCain.
And you really could see that even with John McCain.
Only with they're close, they're simpatico enough with each other. On the social views, I tend to agree with what the caller says with this proviso. People respect the fact that Giuliani's the first president since Eisenhower to come to the race with real accomplishments. First candidate, I should say, to come to the race with real accomplishments.
And you think those would resonate. Fred Siegel, it's been a fascinating insight. It's a great book, and we thank you for writing it. Thank you for being with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Fred Siegel, author of The Prince of the City, Giuliani, New York, and the Genius of American Life. Jack Beatty, please stand by. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be rejoined by our news analyst, Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
The president has said repeatedly, "I am a man of my word." The president really should stand up and prove to the American people that his word is his bond and fire Colin Rove.
Any individual who works here at the White House has the confidence of the president. They wouldn't be working here at the White House if they didn't have the president's confidence.
The investigation quite early led us to have concerns about the movements and activities of four men, three of whom came from the West Yorkshire area. We are trying to establish their movements in the run-up to last week's attacks.
We had an intermittent engine cutoff sensor in the liquid hydrogen tank. It's one of four. We require all four of them to work correctly before we launch. It wasn't working correctly, and so we scrubbed.
Rehnquist says he is not about to announce his retirement. In a statement, the Chief Justice says he wants to, quote, put to rest the speculation and unfounded rumors.
The judge's instruction to the jury about conscious avoidance, we believe, was the jury basically to conclude that Bernie must have known and that was sufficient for the conviction. That is not the legal standard. We can't wait to appeal this case.
I just sort of let my emotions go with it. And, you know, the people were fantastic. And as coming down the last few holes, I'm sitting there and saying, man, I don't want to go through this again. I said, maybe it's just as well I missed the cut.
And there's a week, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson calls for the firing of Karl Rove in connection with the leaking of the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame, Wilson's wife. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says Rove still has the president's confidence. British police conclude last week's terrorist attacks were carried out by homegrown suicide bombers. The launch of the space shuttle Discovery is scrubbed because of a faulty fuel sensor. Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist says rumors of his retirement are premature.
63-year-old former WorldCom CEO Bernie Ebbers is sentenced to 25 years in prison, the stiffest penalty yet in the fallout of the 90s boom corporate scandals. And Jack Nicklaus plays his final hole of competitive golf, birdieing the 18th hole at the British Open today. Despite that birdie, the fabled Golden Bear failed to make the cut. It wasn't all fun and games, though, this week, Jack, and England still coming to grips with everything that's happened.
Yes, and, you know, that model of the enemy within, after September 11th, people said, well, these terrorists lived in the United States. They were here for some months. Mm. Why didn't the American way take on them? Why didn't it soften their hatred? Here's someone born in the West, born in Britain, and raised there, and yet somehow through a subculture, aside from the main culture, full of suicidal hate. Mm. That's an absolutely frightening thought, that you can live in a culture that has, be surrounded by it your whole life, and yet be so fixed within a subculture that the effect of the general culture doesn't reach you at all, or only reaches you as something you reject. And you know, at the end of this line, when you start tracing it back, somewhere we're going to get to thoughts. We're going to get to speeches. We're going to get to people's, representations. And the British may wind up having to censor those things far short of where, you know, full liberty would require, because clearly thoughts and the expression of them help to twist these young men.
It leaves me reminded of how hard it is to come fully to grips with just how globalized the world has become. You know, the notion of communities being no longer geographic or place specific, but frame of mind specific and carried instantly by the internet. I mean, controlling ideas with the technology that are unleashed out there today, extraordinarily difficult idea.
Yes, yes. And if you start to go after Muslim preachers in Britain, at what point do you, where does incitement begin and simply strong language stop?
You just provoke more, in other words.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. It's a tough situation they're in, and to apply it here, and then think of the issue of minorities in British society or minorities here if something happens here. This is a really frightening phenomenon.
We've got to think in new ways here. Karl Rove still sits in the White House tonight, or maybe he's home having a beer. I don't know, Jack. But he's still the president's side. And remarkably, of course, the investigation has a ways to go, and there's a whole new picture of Karl Rove being built by his defenders here as whistleblower, not leaker. But what a picture shaping up this week.
Yeah, and you know, he's being contradicted, things he said in 2004 being contradicted by stuff that's coming out now. But we still haven't got to the issue of consciously knowing this was some sort of undercover operative, consciously knowing that this was illegal to do. And my guess is the president's going to stick with him. I mean, I think President Bush even sees, I mean, what we're seeing again and again with President Bush is performance is no disqualification for his loyalty. You can really mess things up, and he's going to still be loyal to you. So I think he may ride it out with his consigliere.
Well, if he asks his chief political advisor his advice, he may be advised to do just that. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amada, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Persephone Meal, Marika Bukas, Tim Skog, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, supporting the Malaria Vaccine Initiative, in search for a safe and effective malaria vaccine, gatesfoundation.org, the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org, and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations